Good morning and welcome to Talking About California, a series of KZYX discussions that ask Californians to discuss their home, the state of California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. I'm director of the Mendocino Institute, a not-for-profit research and education center here on the coast. Today we're going to be doing something a little bit different. It's Pledge Week at KZYX, and one of the gifts on offer is a new book, West of Eden, Communes and Utopia in Northern California. Today we're going to talk to two of the editors of this volume, which should be of interest to listeners in Northern California and Mendocino County. And we're going to bring in a special guest, John Cote, who's the general manager of KZYX, for his own reflections on the story of Communes and Utopia. So let me begin by introducing, I should say as well, for full disclosure, that I'm one of the editors, and another editor, Michael Watts, was unable to be with us today. But very happily, we have today two of the editors, Janfrey Stone, who many of you may know, but she lived on two communes on the Mendocino coast in the 1970s. She's a teacher of Native American studies and anthropology, and has taught at many levels in the California education system, and has written in volumes such as Sustainable Feminisms and From Rigor to Vigor, Transformations in the Field. Our second editor, Ian Bull, is a social historian of science, techniques, and the commons. He's associated with the Retort Group and was one of the co-authors of Retort's Afflicted Powers, Capital and Spectacle in a New Age of War. He co-edited with James Brooke, Resisting the Virtual Life, the Culture and Politics of Information, and he's the author of The Green Machine, A Brief History of the Bicycle in Planetary Perspective. And of course, many of you will know John Cote. He's the general manager here at KZYX and has been since 2008. He has a 21-year internet career, including being the founder manager of SanFranciscoGate.com. He was the community manager at The Well, the Whole Earth Electronic Link, from 1986 to 1992, and he too lived communally in the 1970s, specifically from 1970 until 1983 at the farm in Tennessee. So we're going to be covering a lot of ground, but it should be very interesting, and we hope that it will inspire interest both in this new volume and in the sustainability of KZYX for all its listeners and its staff. So let's begin, Janfrey. Maybe you could introduce, you've written two chapters in the book, one on Alcatraz and the occupation of Alcatraz, and the second more about your own experiences here in Mendocino County. Could you begin and introduce us to this subject a bit?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think the first thing that I have to say is that one of the things that's really strong about this book is that issue of personal trajectories. You know, even the Alcatraz piece, it's trying to hone in on one person's experience there and thereby, you know, show how the whole thing was tied up with a series of movements. My own personal trajectory, you know, is like this young girl who hitchhiked across Canada and lived in Vancouver for a while and then lived on an island, Texada Island, and then hitchhiked my way down to California because wherever I went, it seemed like this was the center of where it was all beginning, these movements towards living in groups together or, you know, just the whole hitchhiking, you know, crash pad culture. So I hitchhiked down to California and arrived in this Bay Area, but I always had somewhere I was going. My family in British Columbia, the group of people I was living with, had lived in Mendocino up at the Meadow on. So I came directly, do not stop, go. I was headed for the Casper compound, which was, you know, know, small group. It was just 2 acres and 20 people. And if that was close enough quarters, that we all were interacting constantly. And after a while there, I ended up moving to a different...
And Janfrey, when was this? Could you just date it for us? Sure.
What was... I'm sorry?
Oh, the date. So that...
The date was 1970, 71.
Thanks.
Yes, sorry. At the compound, we were all crammed in together. We had a lot of interacting to do. But I would have to say here, there was... the primary social glue was the work. There was the garden. There was art making, whether it was music or embroidery. There was the always changing landscape. There were people who were involved with the ocean, with ocean harvest and diving. And the other thing that was there was we had a very small beginning practice of Zen meditation in the very small Zendo that we had there. And the seeds for a lot of the patterns that were set up in our lives were set there. They were planted there. Many of us have continued to sit over the years, or always return to meditation as a way to keep our lives on course. After a few months there, I met the person who would become the father of my children, and I moved to a different commune, and that one was much more focused on reproduction and production. We were the best raisers of food, and that was our central thing. We were nucleated. We had separate family houses for bedrooms, but then we had the big house, and that was where many of our social interactions took place. And just giving it a little bit of a background there, interestingly enough, this was land that had been bought from Oscar and B. Erickson, and one of the daughter, Sylvia Yoneda Erickson, and now Bartley was part of the group. And therefore, there was a deep awareness that there had been other communal experiments in the Fort Bragg area, and that many of those people had been the people who went to Berkeley, for example, and started the co-op in Berkeley. So there was an awareness of other things going on, but mostly it was daily practice. It was raising food, it was raising children, and it was interacting around the issues of those very nitty-gritties of life. So in terms of what was going on in the coast, I could sit there on my fingers and name, I could name like 7 other communes that I knew about, quite besides the ones that we have named in the book. And we partied together to some extent, and we made music together to some extent. But to a large extent, we were very much land-based wherever we were, that it involved us completely. Is that a good enough introduction?
That's great. That's great, Janfrey. I was just going to say that while you're just telling one story, our calculations are that thousands of young people came through Mendocino County, many of them visiting the communes that you've mentioned along the way. And yet, this is just a small chapter in a much larger story. Is that right, Ian? And we've tried to chronicle a little of that big story of California in the 1960s as a place of communes and utopia.
Yes, Cal, that was really interesting to hear Janfrey setting that scene. I mean, my thoughts on hearing that is that the West of Eden Project, or the Communes Project, as we first called it about 7 or 8 years ago when we began, maybe 8 years ago, I think it's triggered by the fact that the 4 editors were all, in a sense, children of the 60s, and in some way, in different ways, enemies of the present order of things. All born into the post-war Atlantic world, the longest boom in capitalist history, and yet part of that remarkable burst of radical energies, codenamed the 60s, that inspired, as Carol, you've just said, I mean, many thousands to reject what we've thought of as, you know, the kind of assigned roles in the American century. And, you know, we were all based in the ultimately in you know in the Bay Area, which was a very sort of generative node, and we set about it in the spirit of what has been called history from below. I mean, the official story has left a lot of this out, and even the official story from what one might call the left, if we're going to use this word now, has left out what is very largely an, you know, a kind of oral culture. If we talk about, say, the spaces created for the counterculture in the city and the country, in this iteration, they were very unofficial. If you look at what the Back to the Landers used as a way to make shelter for themselves and for their activities, it was highly improvised, and that was true in the city as well. Very interesting contrast that between, say, the 19th century utopian schemes, of which California, of course, was certainly also a focus, which often had kind of blueprints. They were very ambitious, and they were making seeds of a new world, in the new world often. And what happened in the 60s and 70s had a very, in a way, different character to it. So I guess I'd just say that it was very intriguing to us that there was this enormously important history that is still more or less unchronicled. I mean, West of Eden is a book that touches on quite a few of the themes, but we're very well aware of how much remains to be done. And I think people listening to this program, to the extent that they partook of it or know people who, if they're younger, you know, it'll be intriguing them to read these stories, which is a very important part of what happened in this country and in this state and in Mendocino 40, 30 years ago.
Well, John, maybe you should come in now and perhaps with a reflection from your experience. This is John Coate. We've been talking to Jan Freestone and Ian Bull. And John Coates, the general manager here at the station. John?
Yeah, hi. Well, I had I grew up largely in the East Bay, in Castro Valley, which was, you know, kind of a perfect 50s suburban situation. My parents were successful professional people, and everything seemed pretty nice there. And then later in my high school years, we moved to San Francisco, and where we lived was proximate to Golden Gate Park and the Haight-Ashbury, in 1966, '67, '68. And I was already in a rock and roll band by then. And so I was, you know, very much invested in the music culture of the time. And also, I might add that back in those days, the Fillmore and the Avalon Ballroom did not serve alcohol. So you could go as a minor, and, they never checked or anything. And so I was able, as a teenager, to immerse myself quite a bit in the counterculture that was completely available to me, even as a teen. And really, I drank it up. And my parents were liberal. My father was a strong believer in personal freedom, although they were highly educated people. And my brother went to Stanford, and so there was a strong academic pull. But the thing about the times was it wasn't just, let's go have fun and make rock and roll. There was this backdrop of violence and tension. There was the Vietnam War. There was the civil rights movement. There was all of this struggle going on, and the Black Panthers, which are discussed in the book. And, you know, all of that was going on at the same time. And so for me, I was just trying to figure out where I would fit in all of this. And the older I got, the less interested I was in the kind of standard road that was prescribed for me. And also, I had a very strong, what I would describe as a tribal urge, and that the whole idea of tribes was strong then. You know, the human be-in was called a gathering of the tribes. I remember I was only about 16 when I saw that flyer and thinking, yeah, the tribes. I want to see who these tribes are. And so I was very motivated that way. And so in 1969, I started going to these big meetings in San Francisco that were held. When I first went, they were held at the Straight Theater. And then later it was out at this building at the time called the Family Dog on the Great Highway, where this guy, Stephen Gaskin, would have these meetings. And then he would sort of talk to everybody, and people would ask questions, and it was very much the kind of charismatic leader guru model, but it was in a way that made sense to our very eclectic way of looking at things. And so it was very appealing to me, the commonalities of all religion, and what does it mean to have right livelihood, and as above, so below. You know, in other words, if you're going to till the square foot field, you till the square inch field. So if you're going to make a better world, you have to make a better life for yourself. And so that all led me directly into the mode of trying to be the change. That's the kind of person that I was looking to be. And so I joined up with this group, and we went on a big bus caravan, and we settled in Tennessee, and I started living there, and lived there until I was in my 30s, both in Tennessee and also in an urban version of that up in Washington, D.C., and also New York City. So what was interesting to me was, for one thing, I had a lot of choices. You know, I sort of took the spiritual leader route, but coming up to Mendo was one of the options that I considered. Thought about being a deadhead, because I sort of was already. Could have gone to Europe and hitchhiked, could have got a job, but I picked that path, and I stayed on it.
We're going to have to take a couple of breaks this morning. Not have to, we want to. This is the week of the KZYX fun drive, as you know, and I hope that if you find this program interesting and the series interesting, that'll be an inspiration for you to pitch in. This is Talking About California. It's KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow, your host this morning, and we're back. We're talking this morning about a new book, West of Eden, Communes, Utopia, and Communes and Utopia, Northern California. And we're speaking with two of the editors of the book, Ian Bull and Jan Freestone, and John Coate has joined us this morning. Janfrey, I wondered if we could turn to a specific chapter, and maybe you could tell us just a word about what you thought was important about the Alcatraz occupation, but give us an idea of when and where, if you don't mind.
When I came through the Bay Area, I was aware that Alcatraz had been occupied. I was aware that as I was going across the Golden Gate Bridge, that it was drawing to an end. So in 1969, it was occupied in November, and it was the longest-lasting occupation of in the United States, 18 months. And in many ways, it's hard to get people who were there from the very beginning to talk about it, because they exhibit a lot of the signs of being of post-traumatic. It was a traumatic time for them. They started out with a great deal of hope, and in many ways it ended up very badly. But what was interesting to me in talking to Shirley Guevara, who I interviewed for this chapter, is she's so focused upon what was good about it and the ways in which it built family and connections, and how the legacy of it came to be the fact that it was where everyone came to feel like family, and that many of the actions that came out of it came in the American Indian movement. And by the way, AIM was not the impetus for this occupation. It was a group of students at San Francisco State, and it was, you know, people in the Bay Area. It was a California Indian movement, and AIM members did come and visit it. But what she's so focused on, and I have to tell you, the way I interviewed her was she teaches a group of teachers. She takes them out to Alcatraz, and she walks the space with them. So I had the experience of being there in the space as the person talked about it, which is where all the little nuances of the occupation came out, you know, things like how the kids roamed the island, how they set up separate levels of engagement with all the spaces. So I ended up with very much the feeling from talking to her that although it was very traumatic for them, it became the coalescing moment for many of the younger generations who have continued to be involved. And she really emphasized how it was a symbolic space. You know, a lot of people has emphasized that it was just like a reservation. You couldn't make a living there. And so in the end, I turned at the end of this article to an idea of, you know, the contrast between that and what we were trying to do. And I found that one of the greatest contrasts was the involvement with the generations, bringing the elders to the island to teach things that have been forgotten, to teach songs, to teach languages. And then that the message always was, it has to be about land. It has to be about taking care of earth. And it has to be about taking care of all the internet connections. As John was talking, I had a really interesting thought. It was about how he said, you know, how did we come to know back then how things were going on? I was thinking, I hitchhiked across Canada, and there were hitchhikers everywhere. There were coffee shops. There were places you dropped in. It was a physical presence that you had to have in the land, in very high contrast to how many people feel connected today, which is ethereal and through an internet. You know, we live in a click culture rather than in a culture where you have to invest with your hands and your muscle power. So those were the things that that despite the trauma that came out of it and the people that died at Alcatraz or afterwards in the movement, it was the moment that defined we will rise and we will take back, you know, and we will change things. Now, they didn't get what they wanted. They wanted to have a university there. They wanted to have, you know, a huge center there. But they did make major changes, major changes in policy towards Indians in the country. So it was, to me, thinking about it, it was many people don't really know entirely about the occupation as such. And so it's a matter of trying to make sure that we understand that it was a communal effort that was of many tribes. We're back to that word that John used, which was tribalism, and how many of us in the counterculture movement took up that as a concept of organization and way of being. So,
The book West of Eden is dedicated to Jeff Lustig, who's the former head of the California Studies Association. He couldn't be with us today, but I thought maybe Ian could say a word or two about his chapter and about what he describes as the two great commons of the Bay Area. Is that? Can I ask you that, Ian?
Yes, I'm glad you've done that because I'm very happy that the book is dedicated to Jeff. We asked him at one of the gatherings, the conferences, to as somebody who'd been active as a communard in many ways in those times, but also as a very fine radical political scientist. We asked him this question: Jeff, what do you think were the conditions of possibility that made this extraordinary burst of commoning and communalist energies? What was it that made the Bay Area such a special place for this? Because as you said, Carol, at the beginning, in many ways it was a worldwide planetary phenomenon. And Jeff came up with, I think, a very stimulating hypothesis which needs exploring, which was that if you think about the Haight-Ashbury, and so interesting to hear John say that, you know, as a teenager, he was galvanized by what was happening, you know, right there where he was living. Jeff says that that if you think about Haight-Ashbury in the West Bay, and on the east side, Telegraph and Sproul Plaza, that what was crucial in many ways was the adjacency of two great commons or public spaces. On the one hand, the Golden Gate Park, and on the other, the University of California, the Berkeley campus. And just to elaborate a little bit on that, because it's important for, I think, how we try to understand what happened in those years. Firstly, it's important to remember that before Mario Savio, for example, there was a struggle in the Golden Gate Park for public performance. Ron Davis and the Mime Troupe, they were arrested for making political theater without getting the permission of the suits downtown. The commissioners had to give permission for that kind of free speech. Kenneth Rexroth, in a way, the grand old man of Bay Area bohemia and the counterculture, had a column in which he, I think, astutely noted that this was a hugely important struggle and a victory that was, again, one of the conditions of possibility for what happened. And on the other side, the campus, in a way, is a space of gathering for very large numbers. I mean, let me just say one more thing, which is that these two spaces, in a way, are public spaces. They're grand public institutions and spaces. The people of San Francisco refused to allow the developers of what were the old sand dunes out on the west side of the peninsula there. They, after the World's Fair, the Panama Pacific Exposition in 1915, they refused to allow that to be developed. I mean, make no mistake, that would have happened if the people of San Francisco hadn't said, no, we want to keep that park, and yes, we don't want you to pull down the Palace of Fine Arts. That wouldn't have been possible. It would not have been there for these spaces of gathering. And the fact is that these are very, very important conditions. With respect to West of Eden, however, there's an important distinction to be made, which is, I think, central to the book and the way we're thinking about it. And it has to do with the question of scale. I'm fascinated that San Francisco State, which was also, of course, a grand public institution on the west side, incubated Stephen Gaskin and the gatherings that John went to. But these are very large, very large things. We could say that what we're looking at in the West of Eden, right, was in a way on a relatively smaller scale. They were smaller collectivities in general, that when we're looking at the fine grain of this burst of communal energy, they wouldn't be thousands of people, although plenty of these big happenings, of course, are thought of as, you know, actually sort of iconic of the 60s. But often it was smaller gatherings, often households, refunctioned Victorians in the Haight-Ashbury, repurposed empty farmhouses in Mendocino, a Bucky Dome here and there, you know, that it was kind of on a smaller scale. And in a way, it was not public. It's different. Commons have an outside. They can't accommodate everybody. And the most famous of the middle ground communes in Northern California was Morning Star Ranch, which was unfortunately sort of thrown open to everybody by the wonderful trickster who owned the land, Lew Gottlieb, who said, "Come one, come all." But that was a formula for disaster, because it couldn't accommodate the thousands who showed up. And that tells us, and this is my last point on this round, that the sadness, in a way, is that a lot of the wisdom about living on certain, you know, patches of the earth, for thousands of years, human collectivities have, you know, figured out, you know, without being utopian about this, figured out how to do it. And a lot of that had been forgotten. In fact, had been wiped out in the genocide of the commoning cultures that lived here. And Lew Gottlieb, you know, was wrong to believe that the critique of private property that he mounted, that the way to do it was simply to say, well, if you can't, you've just got to sort of turn it upside down and say, absolute exclusion means, well, if we don't like that, we have absolute inclusion. And so I think we still have a tremendous amount to learn, and if the book is useful to young people, it's partly would be the lesson to learn from reading about Lew Gottlieb as we reinvent ways of living together, you know, beyond the world of the commodity and absolute private property.
We're going to take another break now, and I'll remind listeners that this is the Fun Drive week at KZYX. And we hope that this program will inspire you and your support. This morning's program is talking about California, and this morning we're talking to the editors of a new book, West of Eden, Communes and Utopia in Northern California, editors Janfrey Stone and Ian Pohl. We also have John Coate joining us. John's the general manager here at the station, and all three have been talking about the experience of the late 60s and the 70s. I have to say it's been a pretty orderly discussion so far, given the makeup of our participants. So I'm going to get back to John, but I can't believe you all are so nice and agree on everything. But John, maybe something about the what was the provocation from Janfrey about the chip society and the land? Could you come in on that? And as I told you earlier, feel free, Ian and Janfrey, to come right back in. Don't be so polite.
Well, we did want to settle someplace and, you know, live the way we thought was right for us, to model, you know, the life that we thought, you know, it was that be the change kind of life. But, you know, I think that there was the zeitgeist of the time, at least for us countercultural people, was quite a bit of make it up as you go along. I mean, that's definitely a thread of where, I mean, Lew took it to an extreme. But also, you know, being raised in a very orderly 50s world, you know, and then if you are going to, like, quote, live in the moment, you know, where does planning really fit into that? You know, I think because we were a pretty big group, we learned to get organized, but it wasn't really easy. I mean, it was kind of hard. And it also, we spent enormous amounts of time talking to each other about what we thought our problems were, or largely what we thought the other people's problems were, you know, just trying to work it out, as we said. And yeah, so
can I jump in, John, and
yes,
ask you,
please,
and Janfrey something here? I mean, to speak directly to this question of planning, was it not the case, given that both of you in a sense were on the land, that actually planning in a way is forced on you by the rhythms of nature, is it not?
Sure, yeah, of course it is. And and also, like in our experience, like suppose you're a big group and you land on a big undeveloped plot and you want to take a shower. Like, what do you do? How do you do, what do you got to go through just to do that? In our case, that meant find a spring, cap it, pump the water into a storage facility, in our case, a tower, build a shower house. And, you know, at some point a shower was forthcoming, but, you know, we had to learn how to be organized just to pull anything off, even to the point of, like, we're going to build a building. And, you know, if you've been down in those eastern Tennessee woods down there, there's like a million little trees, which means stumps everywhere. And so, you know, the first thing you're going to do is, like, grub all these stumps out just to lay a foundation. And so, and the same was true with farming and gardening. We had to learn how to do all of these things. We had to learn how to become organized in order to not just sort of sink into the mud.
I think all the time that I was traveling, I was always somewhere where you had to start from scratch. You know, you're on an island in British Columbia, and it was, okay, what are the basics of human existence? Okay, first of all, we have to get the outhouses together. Now we have to make sure the water's clean. How are we going to get the water in? Are we just going to lay a pipe into the stream? What is it going to be? And so all those things, people have different knowledge bases, and then a lot of us were just learning out of books as we went along. And so the discussion that would happen over dinner, and then there were always the formalized meetings, which we certainly read about a lot about in the sections of the book that are concentrated on that. It was, you know, those meetings where people would discuss things, plan ahead, get out the calendars, and then of course, yes, once you went into animal husbandry, then it was, when are you going to breed the cow? What does that mean in terms of making sure that she's going to get milked all the time, morning and evening at the same time? You know, what are people's commitments in terms of, yes, I will be there, I will do this, and who didn't do it?
Right, who didn't do it? Right,
who didn't do it? Who didn't take care of the chores?
Janfrey, what about country women and
I was going to say, this is Ian's thing earlier where he was talking about scale. I was looking at the very last little word that Carmen Goodyear wrote, where she talks about disconnecting from the internet now. She recently turned off the internet and find myself living in the same world she was in. This is a world where I can actually make a difference, and one where I am not pushed and pulled by the fears and obsessions of the other 7 billion of us. So it becomes that question of how do we set up the scale. And it's fascinating to talk to John and to think about the farm where there were so many more people who had to be taken care of. And what's more, with that open invitation from Ellen Mae Gaskin, you know, that people who were women who were considering having an abortion should come there and have their babies. I mean, it became a matter of how, looking at the basics of society, looking at the basics of culture, how do you truly support each other? And when is everything going to get stretched too thin? And then what happens?
Yeah,
you know,
no
how
question.
Do we work that out?
Right. And it is true that, you know, I think in any organization, you have some people who naturally work hard and some people who don't. And then I would consider myself to be somebody who learned to work hard through the process. All I knew how to do was play guitar and mow a lawn, basically. there were some very motivated, hardworking people, and I started very young. You know, I was a teenager in 1970. I was still a teenager, and you know, there was this kind of they would sort of say to me, you know, look, we like you, but you know, if you're going to really hang around here, you're going to have to put out. You're going to have to, you know, learn how to truck. So my desire to be part of the group was a motivator for me, and I became a hard worker, and frankly, that's where I developed my work ethic, which I like to think I still have.
But Ian, it didn't work, did it? And a question recently put to us was, why do we even use the word utopia? So there's a question for the editors. Why use this word utopia if it's about impossibilities?
Yeah, well, of course, Carol, that's quite right. And it had a lot of this had a tremendous improvised sense to it. But as Janfrey and I think we wondered long ago what kinds of books were people reading? How was the imagination being fed in the 50s, 60s, 70s? What was a utopia if it wasn't a utopia of consumption? I mean, I think that's absolutely crucial. We've got to remember that one of the huge threats offered by this fraction of a whole generation that refused the script that was on offer. I mean, as John described, growing up in Castro Valley, I mean, you were being trained to, for a life of consumption, where the heaven on earth is to do with white goods and the latest application. You know, in a way, we're back into that world now. Now, of course, it in many ways, it all did seem, in many ways, and did, as Janfrey mentioned about Alcatraz, it kind of ended badly. for many. And we could say that this book was written in some sense out of an experience of defeat, although we were often confronted by people, you know, a proper refusal to say that it was a defeat, that we will never regret, you know, what happened there. One of the things that was helpful to us as we wrote the book was the work done in a very large exhibition, first in Paris and then at the New York Public Library, on the history of utopia, the story of utopia, of these often literary imaginings. And what was striking about the one in New York, at least, I didn't see the one at the Bibliothèque Nationale, but was there were kind of wall texts as you got towards the end of the exhibit in one of the rooms or the galleries, which basically warned you that all these experiments will absolutely end badly. It must, whether it's the Paris Commune of 1871, Kronstadt in Russia, you know, Jonestown, you know, Helter Skelter. That's always the message. And remember that the most important ideological document of the sort of neoliberal era, you know, the era which says privatization and strict private property right demarcations is the only way to make the world work efficiently. This famous essay called The Tragedy of the Commons, basically that's the drumbeat. It was written in 1968, just as these experiments were flourishing. The counterculture was in a way in its heyday at that moment, and this essay was published in Science magazine, journal. Very famous, fact-free argument that commoning can never work. This is utopian. It's hopeless. And I think what we've uncovered here is showing that actually that's not true. It's simply not true. I mean, there are many things that we need to lessons to be learned. But it's not true. And anyway, compared to what? I mean, Cal is fond of, I know you're fond of asking this question, which is a proper one. Okay, so these collective experiments often were could be personally disastrous. I'm thinking specifically about the guru who is also, you know, let's put it bluntly, a sexual predator. Let's think about, you know, the authoritarian communes that go by the name of, you know, cults or something like that. But actually, we ask ourselves, well, in the wider culture, is a kind of chaotic household in the Haight-Ashbury, how much worse was that than, you know, the Valium-soaked nuclear suburb? That's the debate that I hope that West of Eden will stimulate.
And so we're constantly told that there is no alternative to what we have out there, to war and capitalism and conformity. And the book, then, it seems to me, we're saying, is unashamed in its celebrating the alternatives of this period. And I don't know, is that fair, John, or
yeah,
Jennifer?
Sure, it's fair. I think it's fair because, I mean, I would say, well, how many people who spent a piece of their lives, or speaking of me, a piece of our lives trying something, you know, really reaching for something, you know, yeah, sure, maybe it crashed and burned on some level, but are we sorry we even tried? I mean, I've met few people who totally regret it.
More than that, I would have to ask, what kind of world would it be where youth doesn't dream? So many of these things were youthful impulses, and then we did commit to ourselves. And we committed our youthful bodies. We committed ourselves to those dreams. And we may not have gotten very far with it, and we may have gotten a long way with it, and we may have had unintended results. But that's what the human life cycle is about. It's about dreaming when you're a youngster and going for it. And learning, as John said, on the ground and being tutored somewhat by older people, but just really moving forward with this wonderful energy. And, I mean, it would be a terrible world if that wasn't the case. So it's like I look at the idea of utopia and I go, okay, so we read about some other places where this happened. we read Walden, we read Thoreau, we read Emerson, you know, we read those things, or we read even more deeply, but then we did it.
Yeah, you know, I once went to a reunion party at Morningstar, where it was, and it was quite well attended. I mean, there were dozens and dozens of people who had lived at Morningstar during that tumultuous and sort of legendary time. And, you know, it was a wonderful gathering. And the stories and the feelings that they had for this thing that they tried for was, it was, I felt privileged to be there. So, you know, if you ask them if they crashed and burned, they would say at one level, yeah, and at another level, what came out of it for them, you couldn't get at any price.
Ian, you've got a minute for what's the future of this project?
Well, look, things are very serious. We live in a world in which it's clear that our masters have no plan B. The reign of the commodity has got to come to an end. Now, to the extent that, you know, a generation of young people inventing it sort of on the hoof got things wrong. Well, actually, it turns out that half the world is still going commoning, that's to say, outside the cash nexus. I mean, I think we have no option, Cal, but to offer this book in a way as a message in a bottle. In some way, things are looking increasingly bad. I mean, it may be that we're facing the end of coastal civilization. But even so, then, you know, lots of young bodies are going to have to get together in the spirit of cooperation to build a new world on the new shorelines, if it's a 50-foot rise. I mean, things are looking very serious, but I you know, we have no option, and there's much to celebrate in this book.
Our program this morning is talking about California. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. Today we've been talking about a new volume, West of Eden, Communes and Utopia in Northern California. It's the publication of PM Press, and we all give thanks to the generous work of the staff of PM Press. We would like to thank KZYX for allowing us time for this discussion, and in turn, we would urge listeners to contribute generously. Thanks very much, and thanks, John. Thanks, Janfrey, and thanks, Ian.